the method and the means. In regard to the method and the means of Bhakti Yoga, we read in the commentary of Bhagavan Ramanuja on the Vedanta Sutras. The attaining of that comes through discrimination, controlling the passions, practice, sacrificial work, purity, strength, and suppression of excessive joy. Viveka or discrimination is, according to Ramanuja, discriminating among other things the pure food from the impure. According to him, food becomes impure from three causes. 1. By the nature of the food itself, as in the case of garlic, etc. 2. Owing to its coming from wicked and accursed persons. And 3. From physical impurities such as dirt or hair, etc. The Shrutis say, when the food is pure, the sattva element gets purified and the memory becomes unwavering. And Ramanuja quotes this from the Chandogya Upanishad. The question of food has always been one of the most vital with the bhaktas. Apart from the extravagance into which some of the bhakti sects have run, there is a great truth underlying this question of food. We must remember that according to the Sankhya philosophy, the sattva, rajas and tamas, which in the state of homogeneous equilibrium form the prakriti, and in the heterogeneous disturbed condition form the universe, are both the substance and the quality of prakriti. As such, they are the materials out of which every human form has been manufactured. And the predominance of the sattva material is absolutely necessary for spiritual development. The materials which we receive through our food into our body structure go a great way to determine our mental constitution. Therefore, the food we eat has to be particularly taken care of. However, in this matter, as in others, the fanaticism into which the disciples invariably fall is not to be laid at the door of the masters. And this discrimination of food is, after all, of secondary importance. The very same passage quoted above is explained by Shankara in his Bhashya on the Upanishads in a different way by giving an entirely different meaning to the word ahara, translated generally as food. According to him, that which is gathered in is ahara. The knowledge of the sensations, such as sound, etc., is gathered in for the enjoyment of the enjoyer. The purification of the knowledge which gathers in the perception of the senses is the purifying of the food. The word purification of food means the acquiring of the knowledge of sensations untouched by the defects of attachment, aversion and delusion. Such is the meaning. Therefore, such knowledge or ahara being purified, the sattva material of the possessor of it, the internal organ, will become purified, and the sattva being purified, an unbroken memory of the Infinite One who has been known in his real nature from scriptures will result. These two explanations are apparently conflicting, yet both are true and necessary. The manipulating and controlling of what may be called the finer body, wise the mind, are no doubt higher functions than the controlling of the grosser body of flesh. But the control of the grosser is absolutely necessary to enable one to arrive at the control of the finer. The beginner, therefore, must pay particular attention to all such dietic rules as have come down from the line of his accredited teachers. But the extravagant, meaningless fanaticism, which has driven religion entirely to the kitchen, as may be noticed in the case of many of our sects, without any hope of the noble truth of that religion ever coming out to the final light of spirituality is a peculiar sort of pure and simple materialism. It is neither jnana, nor bhakti, nor karma. It is a special kind of lunacy, and those who pin their souls to it are more likely to go to lunatic asylums than to Brahmaloka. So it stands to reason that discrimination in the choice of food is necessary for the attainment of this higher state of mental composition, which cannot be easily obtained otherwise. Controlling the passions is the next thing to be attended to. To restrain the indriyas from going towards the objects of the senses, to control them and bring them under the guidance of the will, is the very central virtue in religious culture. Then comes the practice of self-restraint and self-denial. All the immense possibilities of divine realization in the soul cannot get actualized without struggle and without such practice on the part of the aspiring devotee. The mind must always think of the Lord. It is very hard at first to compel the mind to think of the Lord always, but with every new effort, the power to do so grows stronger in us. By practice, O son of Kunti, and by non-attachment is it attained, says Sri Krishna in the Gita. And then as to sacrificial work, it is understood that the five great sacrifices, Pancha Mahayajna, have to be performed as usual. Purity is absolutely the basic work, the bedrock upon which the whole bhakti building rests. Cleansing the external body and discriminating the food are both easy, but without internal cleanliness and purity, these external observances are of no value whatsoever. In the list of qualities conducive to purity, as given by Ramanuja, there are enumerated Satya, truthfulness, Arjava, sincerity, Daya, doing good to others without any gain to oneself, Ahimsa, not injuring others by thought, word or deed, Anabhidya, not coveting others' goods, not thinking vain thoughts, and not brooding over injuries received from another. In this list, the one idea that deserves special notice is Ahimsa, non-injury to others. This duty of non-injury is, so to speak, obligatory on us in relation to all beings. As with some, it does not simply mean the non-injuring of human beings and mercilessness towards the lower animals, nor, as with some others, does it mean the protecting of cats and dogs and feeding of ants with sugar, with liberty to injure brother man in every horrible way. It is remarkable that almost every good idea in this world can be carried to a disgusting extreme. A good practice carried to an extreme and work in accordance with the letter of the law becomes a positive evil. The stinking monks of certain religious sects who do not bathe, lest the vermin on their bodies should be killed, never think of the discomfort and disease they bring to their fellow human beings. They do not, however, belong to the religion of the Vedas. The test of ahimsa is absence of jealousy. Any man may do a good deed or make a good gift on the spur of the moment or under the pressure of some superstition or precept, but the real lover of mankind is he who is jealous of none. The so-called great men of the world may all be seen to become jealous of each other for a small name, for a little fame, and for a few bits of gold. So long as this jealousy exists in a heart, it is far away from the perfection of ahimsa. The cow does not eat meat, nor does the sheep. Are they great yogis? Great non-injurers? Any fool may abstain from eating this or that. Surely that gives him no more distinction than to herbivorous animals. The man who will mercilessly cheat widows and orphans and do the vilest deeds for money is worse than any brute, even if he lives entirely on grass. The man whose heart never cherishes even the thought of injury to anyone, who rejoices at the prosperity of even his greatest enemy, that man is the bhakta, he is the yogi, he is the guru of all, even though he lives every day of his life on the flesh of swine. Therefore, we must always remember that external practices have value only as helps to develop internal purity. It is better to have internal purity alone when minute attention to external observances is not practicable. But woe unto the man and woe unto the nation that forgets the real internal spiritual essentials of religion and mechanically clutches with death-like grasp at the external forms and never lets them go. The forms have value only so far as they are expressions of the life within. If they have ceased to express life, crush them out without mercy. The next means to the attainment of Bhakti Yoga is strength. This Atman is not to be attained by the weak, says the Shruti. Both physical weakness and mental weakness are meant here. The strong, the hardy are the only fit students. What can puny, little, decrepit things do? They will break to pieces whenever the mysterious forces of the body and mind are even slightly awakened by the practice of any of the yogas. It is the young, the healthy, the strong that can score success. Physical strength, therefore, is absolutely necessary. It is a strong body alone that can bear the shock of reaction resulting from the attempt to control the organs. He who wants to become a bhakta must be strong, must be healthy. When the miserably weak attempt any of the yogas, they are likely to get some incurable malady or they weaken their minds. Voluntarily weakening the body is really no prescription for spiritual enlightenment. The mentally weak also cannot succeed in attaining the Atman. The person who aspires to be a bhakta must be cheerful. In the Western world, the idea of a religious man is that he never smiles, that a dark cloud must always hang over his face, which again must be long drawn with the jaws almost collapsed. People with emaciated bodies and long faces are fit subjects for the physician. They are not yogis. It is the cheerful mind that is persevering. It is the strong mind that hews its way through a thousand difficulties. And this, the hardest task of all, the cutting of our way out of the net of Maya, is the work reserved only for giant wills. Yet, at the same time, excessive mirth should be avoided. Excessive mirth makes us unfit for serious thought. It also fritters away the energies of the mind in vain. The stronger the will, the less the yielding to the sway of emotions. Excessive hilarity is quite as objectionable as too much of sad seriousness, and all religious realization is possible only when the mind is in a steady, peaceful condition of harmonious equilibrium. It is thus that one may begin to learn how to love the Lord.